Chapter 15. Once we put away all the gun cleaning supplies and all of us took showers, the five of us settled in the living room of Ipsith's house. "Do you want to order pizza, baby?" I asked Ipsith as I came down the stairs with my hair still damp. "That way you can relax?"
"Absolutely not, beloved."
The white-haired woman shook her head as she smiled at me.
"Tonight I will make my family the best dinner they have ever had. And after, I would like it if we played a game together or talked instead of watching a movie."
Ipsith was still smiling and spoke in a light tone, but I knew her very well and could see the worry just behind her violet eyes. My first wife knew I would leave for the gloom in the morning, and she wanted tonight to be special. "Sounds incredible." I smiled back at her and kept the mood light. "Your cooking is way better than any takeout anyway, but I'm going to insist on doing the dishes tonight."
"Why would you do that?"
Ipsith asked with a confused look on her heart-shaped face. "Because that was something nice my dad would do for my mom." I shrugged. We were poor, so both my parents worked. Mom would cook, and Pop would do the dishes. Pop wasn't good with words, and Mom always said that was one of the ways she knew he loved her.
"Oh."
Ipsith sighed as she thought about the idea.
"That is a lovely story."
"I'm gonna run out and get some beer real quick," I said as I put my arms around my elven woman's tiny waist. "Do you want anything?"
"I have all I could ever ask for already."
Ipsith purred, and she got up on her tiptoes to kiss me. "I'll be back soon." I grinned at the petite woman. Then I put on my boots, grabbed my keys, and went out the back door. "Growler, buddy!" I called. "Let's go for a ride!" The two garms ran toward me like white streaks, and their long red ears flapped with each bound of their powerful legs. It was like they got bigger every time I saw them. "Look at you boys!" I grinned as I crouched down to pet them. "You gonna look after Mommy while I'm gone?" "Yes, you are." The boys panted and wagged their tails as they tried to vie for more pets and affection. "Dred, stay," I commanded, and to his credit, Dred sat on his hindquarters and his tail continued to wag back and forth behind him. "I'll take you on the next car ride, but you need to stay and watch the yard tonight." I knew the Garm couldn't understand me, but my sense of fairness felt better all the same. I favored Growler because he'd chosen me as his person, but I loved them both. When I got back, I'd take them both out to the woods for a hike and let them run around and chase rabbits and squirrels to their heart's content. Growler and I went out the side gate, and I made sure to latch the gate behind me. Then we got into the Rubicon and drove to the closest drive-thru. When I pulled in for my turn in line, a young kid walked up to my window. The guy was probably only a year or two younger than me and covered in tattoos and piercings, and I realized how much my new life had changed me. I'd be 22 in a month, and somehow this guy seemed a lot younger than me. The edgy kid gave off the vibe of someone who hadn't found their way in the world yet, and probably spent all his time dreaming about the day he got out of this town. A few months ago, that had been me, minus all the ink and metal. "Oh, man," Tattoo said as he saw Growler in the back. "Your dog's fucking rad, dude." "Thanks." I smiled as I looked at the small plastic name tag on the kid's shirt. "Mike?"
"What kind of dog is that?"
Mike asked.
"He looks like the Green Man's dogs."
"The what?" I snorted at the crazy statement.
"The Green Man,"
the pierced kid said with a stoner's drawl.
"He's this dude from Celtic myths. He, like, wanders around the wilderness with these two sick-ass dogs that have white fur and red ears like that. He's the protector of nature, some shit."
"I've never heard of that before," I replied as I wondered about what the connection might be. "Where'd you hear about that?"
"Internet,"
Mike shrugged.
"Anyway, what can I get for you?"
"I'd like three cases of Youngling," I said. "Bottles. And do you carry any kind of non-alcoholic drinks? My wife is pregnant, but I'd like to get something nice for her, too."
"Having a rager,"
Mike drawled with an approving smile.
We got these kind of artisan pops with sugarcane, man. We sell them as mixers. There's melon, cucumber, and lavender."
"Lavender?" I repeated with a raised eyebrow.
No.
The tattooed attendant snickered and shook his head.
"It sounds kind of wild. Everyone gets the melon, but I'm telling you, the lavender one is the best."
"Okay," I shrugged. "I'll take some then."
"Sick."
Mike nodded, and then he started to walk around the coolers to get my order. The kid rang up the items and fiddled around with something behind the cash wrap before he came back up.
"That'll be $79.96,
Mike told me.
"And we keep these milk bones at the register for customers with dogs. Cool if I give them a couple?"
"Sure," I replied, and then I rolled down the back window. Mike walked to the open window and held up a handful of dog biscuits.
"Here you go, boy,"
the kid said as he clicked his tongue. Growler poked his head through the window, stared at the tattooed guy, and gave a low growl. Mike froze, and his eyes went wide as he looked at the big arm. "It's okay, Growler," I said from the front seat as I tried not to laugh. Growler sniffed the kid's outstretched hand, took the milk bones, and then turned his back on Mike as he settled in the back seat to eat them in peace.
"Fucking sick,"
I heard Mike say under his breath in a tone of stoner wonder. Then the attendant loaded my drinks into the back and brought me the receipt. I signed and left a generous tip before I drove back home. I thought about the Green Man on the way and wondered if the surface and the underground world might have been more connected before. Were there other places like the Gloom in Ireland? Is that where all human myths came from? When I got back, all the women were in the kitchen as they laughed and joked together. Ibsith was at the stove, while Bulra chopped up some veggies for a salad. And Amrila and Nilame were at the table, almost doubled over with laughter. The whole house smelled like roasted meat, herbs and spices, and my mouth watered. "What are y'all talking about?" I grinned as I set down a case of beer and let Growler out the back door.
"They were telling me about the orc you wrestled,"
Ibsith snorted.
"I wish I could have seen that. It sounded like quite a victory."
"It was something," I smirked. "Did Amrila tell you the part where she goaded me into it so she could win some money?"
"Nilame did."
Bulra giggled as she threw her veggies into a large bowl and started to toss them together.
"Why not bet on a sure thing?"
The horned woman shrugged as she opened the case of beer and started to pass them out.
"It seems silly not to."
"I got you these, darling," I said to Ibsith as I handed her a bottle of lavender pop and kissed her.
"But the baby..."
Ibsith frowned as she lightly placed her hand on her stomach. "It's just pop," I explained. "But a really nice kind. I thought you should have something special, too."
"Oh, thank you, husband."
The white-haired woman breathed as she took the bottle. The pop was a pretty color, and the label hinted at a small-scale, local kind of operation.
"Oh!"
The curvy elf gasped as she took a sip.
"Oh, it's wonderful! Like a sweet herbal tea with a fizz."
Ibsith had me try a sip, and it was not for me. The lavender taste wasn't overpowering, but something about the floral taste didn't feel right in a pop. "I'm glad you like it," I replied as I grimaced. The dinner was incredible. Ibsith made a juicy roast with potatoes and gravy, served with a side of corn on the cob and Bulra's tossed salad. We ate and drank our fill as Ibsith asked us about our adventures in the gloom. It was the most interest my wife had shown in what our lives underground were like, and I wondered if part of her was a little homesick. Maybe it was just that the petite woman wanted to hear stories of past victories. Ibsith would listen when my other wives and I talked about battles we'd fought, but she only ever asked about the people we had befriended. That was the elven woman's way, though. Ibsith cared about everyone, and she would ask about Bakoth's new baby, how Chief Ekname was, or if Scourge was well. After dinner, Ibsith, Amrila, and Nilame went over to the trailer to pick one of my grandpa's old board games for us to play. I got up and started to gather up the dishes, and Bulra stayed to help me.
"This world of yours is a wonder,"
the mystic commented as she scraped some of the plate scraps into the trash. "I like it," I grinned as I put away some leftovers. "The surface has a lot of things the gloom doesn't, but I like the gloom too."
"The surface is delightful,"
the shaman nodded.
"But that isn't what I meant."
"What do you mean?" I asked as I placed some Tupperware in the fridge.
"I mean, the world that you have made,"
Bulra explained with a whimsical smile.
"The life you have here, with your incredible wives, your love and generosity have made this the most peaceful home I have ever seen. Most of the time, wives vie for attention and position, especially in large, wealthy households."
"That sounds like the worst," I said as I started to rinse the plates as the orcish woman handed them to me. Ibsith had already rinsed the pots and pans and put them in the dishwasher. Despite my offer to clean up, my first wife had struggled to not take care of everything herself.
"The surface world is wonderful,"
Bulra continued in a shy tone.
"But it's you that makes it special."
The pretty orc looked at me as she handed me the last plate, and her green eyes searched my face with an unspoken question. "It's not just me," I said as I reached for the plate. "Every one of my wives are special in their own ways. I didn't pick them at random. I didn't know I could love so much and still have something to give." I let one of my fingers caress Bulra's hand as I took the plate, and I watched her full breasts rise with a sudden intake of breath. There was something undeniable about the willowy woman's appeal. It was natural and effortless, a sort of comfort and homey feeling that made me think of campfires and wood smoke. But there was also an air of mystery and hidden knowledge there. I wondered if she'd seen this moment in one of her visions and waited with anticipation for it to come to pass.
ready, my king?
I suddenly heard Ibsith's voice from the living room.
We have returned with Boggle and Monopoly.
I like having you here, I said quietly, as I dried my hands with a dish towel and looked into Bora's emerald eyes.
I like being here.
The mystic replied in a breathy voice as she returned my gaze. Good. Then let's go join the others. I smiled warmly at the green-skinned woman, and I put my arm around her waist as I led her back into the living room. Then my wives, Bora, and I spent the rest of the evening playing games and making lighthearted conversation. The alarm on my phone went off early the next morning, and I opened my eyes to see Ibsith was curled up next to me, with her bare skin pressed against mine. My other wives had agreed that the violet-eyed woman should have me to herself for the night, since we had to leave today. The invasion was only a couple of days away, and it was hard to say how long we would be gone. I turned off the alarm and looked back at Ibsith, and her eyes fluttered open as they looked at me.
Good morning, beloved,
she murmured with a smile. Good morning, baby, I replied. Then I kissed her full lips and took my time before I got out of bed.
I'll make breakfast,
Ibsith said as she got out of bed and walked over to the dresser, and her large, bare breasts bounced lightly with each delicate step.
I will make some extra muffins for the dwarves, too. Do you think they'll like that?
They always do, I snorted. Even Doram seems happy when he eats your cooking. After breakfast, Amrila, Nilame, and I got everything we needed together, and Ibsith and Bora came to the trailer to see us off.
Be well, my king,
the white-haired woman said as she hugged me and gave me one last kiss before I left.
Hurry home, sisters. I will make a feast for us when you get back. Tell Zuag that I love and miss him,
Bulra told me as I said goodbye to her.
And let him know that I am well. He will be worried.
Of course. I smiled at the shaman. The ladies all took a moment to hug and say their goodbyes, and then the five of us quietly went out into the backyard. Ibsith and Bulra held each other's hands for comfort as they watched Amrila, Nilame, and I go down into the trapdoor, and I cast the pair of women one more smile before I turned to the tunnel entrance. I had taken the time to replace the damaged part of the metal door, and I made sure it was still locked before I went back down the ladder. As I got to the bottom, I took one of the cases of beer from Nilame, and Amrila carried a plastic container with the muffins Ibsith had made for the dwarves. Then we went to the Citadel to see what Sagor and the others had worked up for us over the last few days. When the three of us entered the dwarves' workroom, I saw several large bundles of weapons on one of the tables, along with two cloth sacks. All of the dwarves were there, and they gathered around us. They all looked like they hadn't slept much lately, but Sagor seemed like the worst for wear.
These are the new bullets,
Torek said as he brought over two large sacks.
I made as many as I could.
Thank you, I nodded. I know I asked a lot this time, but it looks like you four got it all done. I owe you a lot.
Our pleasure, Eddie.
Becklin grinned as he munched on a muffin with a beer in his other hand.
Between us, we were able to treat all of the weapons with an infusion of radiant energy. The bows were an especially invigorating challenge.
Of all the dwarves, the little red-bearded man was in the best spirits. Becklin was younger, and I wonder by how much compared to the others. Years? Centuries? The lifespans of the people from the gloom made my head spin.
I found the arcane symbols we needed,
Doram huffed as he opened a beer.
But your archers should know there's a limit to the charges. I would guess they'll have 100 shots each. But after that, the magic will weaken and possibly start to damage the structure of the bows from the energy exchange.
Good to know,
Amrila snorted.
Also treated your swords, madam,
Tora continued as he lifted the blades from the table next to us.
The plain one has the light infusion, but the other has some ancient magic on it already. I honed the blade and repaired the handle, which had a small crack in it. It's a fine thing. Whatever is in that onyx stone is quite powerful.
Amrila took her swords, tested the edge, and smiled with satisfaction.
Beautiful work, Torek.
The horned woman complimented the blacksmith.
That just leaves this.
Sagor smiled, but his eyes didn't have their usual sparkle. The old dwarf handed me a jagged dagger. The blade was a dark metal I couldn't place, and there was a crimson stone in the handle that had a bright strip in it when it caught the light. What's this? I asked as I looked at the odd jewel.
A relic of war,
Doram said in a dark voice as he took a pull from his beer.
It was once a demonic weapon,
the eldest dwarf explained.
The original jewel was destroyed long ago to break a curse, but we have replaced it with a gem made from the demon's blood you brought us. It will give whoever wields the blade the ability to go unseen for a short time, and when it's used to draw blood, the blade will absorb some of it to power the exchange of magical energy.
Scourge is going to love that.
Nyla May snorted. I don't know what to say. I breathed, other than thank you all.
Keep the tunnel safe,
Sago replied in a solemn voice.
That is thanks enough.
I nodded, and my wives and I said goodbye to the dwarves and carried the heavy bundles of weapons through the tunnels. When we arrived at the encampment a few hours later, the Dolorath capital teemed with soldiers in beetle shell armor. The warriors from all of the Dolorath clans had converged on the encampment, and many of them had smaller tents set up on the outskirts of the city. It looked as if the capital had tripled in size while I was gone. The three of us walked through the crowded streets and searched for Bakoth. We found him in an open area not far from the river, as he ran a familiar group of soldiers through drills. But I did notice a new face among the soldiers that had followed me to Takfet. It was a younger elf, with a shock of hair even redder than Bakoth's mohawk.
"Hail, your majesty!"
the hawk-faced general called out as he came over to us.
"The soldiers are ready for your inspection."
The warriors lined up without being told, and waited for me to inspect them. I had no idea what the protocol was, so I set my bundle and backpack on the ground next to my wives and shot Bakoth a look. "I see you got your new eye," I commented, as I noticed the blood-red jewel in the socket where he'd lost his eye in the swamps.
"Indeed,"
the general smirked. "It was a gift from the chief. What do you think?"
"It works," I chuckled. "Very unsettling."
"Fika makes me take it out when we're alone together,"
Bakoth snorted, and then he motioned with one hand toward the soldiers.
"You remember the archers, Chatteron and Therius?"
I nodded as we walked past the two. Chatteron's bald head shone like a beacon, and I assumed that he'd freshly shaved it this morning. Farias's burgundy braids were tight, and they kept her long hair out of the way.
"Canel?"
Bakoth continued as we walked down the line. The short man's twin blades were polished and free of nicks, and his white mohawk had been greased so that it stood up straight.
"Cyneath, the scout?"
The general pointed to the slim woman, whose white hair had also been braided, and the sides of her head were recently shaved.
"An honor to serve you again, shield brother,"
the young elven woman replied with a broad smile.
"Then we have Ezreal."
Bakoth glanced at the older warrior with short silver hair and a great sword slung on his back.
"And lastly, this is Anadan."
Anadan had a short red mohawk and was little taller than the other soldiers.
"Thank you for having me, shield brother."
The young elf I didn't recognize bowed and was clearly nervous.
"My father and uncle both served with you. It's a great honor."
I could only think of two men that had fought with me before this, Irilak and Aralor, two brothers who'd both died in different confrontations.
"Are you Aralor's son?"
I asked, as I looked at the young man and noted the similarities between him and the polearm master who died in the fight with Igerg.
"Yes, sir."
Anadan nodded as he kept his eyes respectfully forward.
"Both of my mothers thank you for returning his ashes from Takfet."
"Anadan is a fine swordsman,"
Bakoth added with a fatherly smile.
"He will make his family proud."
"Thank you for being here," I said to the young warrior as I reached my hand toward him. "Your father and uncle were both fine men and great warriors."
"Thank you, shield brother."
Anadan grinned at me as he shook my hand.
"Oh, I also have gifts for all of you," I said as I looked around at the soldiers.
My wives and I passed out the weapons we'd brought, and I was thankful to see the dwarves had even sent several spare swords and an extra bow.
"Shield brother,"
Canel said as he looked over the swords I handed him with awe.
"These are dwarven made, but they're unlike any I've ever seen."
"I have my sources," I said evasively, because I didn't want to bring up the lost dwarves. "They're all enchanted with magic that will help us fight Ursinger and whatever abominations he throws our way."
"Magnificent."
The hawk-faced general breathed as he looked at his new broadsword, and his red, jeweled eye reflected back at him in the steel.
"Come, shield brother, we should get to the meeting house. The chief is there with the other generals to go over the plan for our invasion."
"I'll stay here and work with the soldiers,"
Amrila said.
"I'll take them through the troll maneuver and some of the other tactics we've been working on."
"That's a good idea," I nodded. "We'll be back."
"All hail, Eddie Hill,"
Chatteron shouted as we turned to leave.
"Hero of Takfet and slayer of the basilisk."
A sudden cheer went up all around us, not just my soldiers, but what sounded like half the encampment. I was stunned and a little embarrassed, but at least it was only one basilisk this time. As we walked to the meeting house,
I saw a group of Grimthorn soldiers outside the large wooden building. Their plain brown leather armor and stoic expressions made them seem dour, but I was glad to see at least a dozen spike keepers among them. The strange, silent warriors with spiked vine sprouts in their packs would come in handy. When we entered the meeting house, I was glad that Pakoth didn't feel the need to announce me with 20 or more ridiculous titles. I guess the wartime protocol didn't demand that kind of formality.
Daughter,
Ekname greeted the princess with a warm smile.
And my new son. I am glad you are here.
The chief led us over to where two of the long tables had been pushed together, and a large map of the Yinni territory had been placed in the center. Gathered around the table were a group of stern-faced Dolrath generals and one gnome in Grimthorn armor. I'd seen the sandy-haired gnome before, but I didn't know who he was.
As you know,
Ekname said as she showed me the map that was covered in colored tokens to represent the different armies.
The plan is for the Kharadu forces to come from the north, while we come up from the south to try and flank Ursinger's forces.
Do we know yet how we're going to lure Ursinger to the forest? I asked.
A campaign of intrigue and misinformation.
A familiar, wry voice said from the back of the meeting house. Scourge sauntered up to the table as several generals made room for the slinky thief. The Zinkari man had recapped the tips of his black horns with gold, and a teardrop-shaped amethyst dangled from one.
My friends in the Resistance have spread rumors that we plan to gather there to assault the Yinni capital.
The gray-skinned man said with the air of a cat that had just caught a fat mouse.
And then Lady Ekname sent Vimin's spy with similar information to the Mad Chief.
Really? I asked, as I looked at the chief with a surprised expression. How'd you convince him to do that?
I left a letter, addressed to Murdrak, conveniently lying around my tent.
The tall, dark-haired woman replied with a dark smile.
Then I just as conveniently discovered Vemin as he handed it off to one of his lackeys, and I ran my sword through him as the messenger ran away.
The generals all laughed as they admired the Dolrath chief's cleverness. It was a solid move. The messenger would think they'd gotten away with precious information that was sensitive enough to make the chief turn on her consort. Plus, now that slimy Vemin was taken care of. Ekname was a scary woman when she wanted to be.
We even have a small force in the forest, Scourge added, to make it look as though we are slowly gathering there, if Ursinger sends scouts to confirm the rumors.
That's good, I nodded. I think I've an idea too, but I'm not 100% sure it'll work.
Let's hear it, my son,
Ekname replied as she sat on the edge of the table. When the invasion starts, I explained as I looked at the map, and we have Ursinger's army hemmed in, would it be possible for the armies to cut a path for me and my soldiers through the Yinni army?
Possibly.
Bakoth nodded as he looked at the map.
To what end?
Ursinger is a coward. I started to think out loud as I rubbed my chin. But he'll know that he has to be there or he'll look like a coward. I'm thinking he'll plant himself in a comfortable position right in the middle of his army. If you all can cut a path for me, I can run with my soldiers and some of the spike keepers. Then, if the spike keepers can create a wall of thorns around us and trap the mad chief, my warriors and I can take him out.
But that will still leave the rest of his army for us to deal with.
A broad-faced general with a graying mohawk replied.
And we'll have expended some of our forces to cut through the Yinni army.
But will they keep fighting after their leader is dead? I asked with an intent expression. Ursinger has access to some powerful magic. How many of his generals are following him willingly? Not only that, the man's a bastard, who controls his people with fear. Why would they fight if he isn't around to force them to?
Oh,
Scourge snorted.
That is clever.
But can the spike keepers make a wall like that with their little sproutlings?
Another general asked skeptically.
Yes.
The sandy-haired general replied in a firm voice and caused several of the bigger warriors to jump when he spoke. All eyes turned to the little man, whose eyes were now fixed firmly on the map. They were clearly as shocked as I was to hear a Grimthorn gnome speak out loud.
My spike keepers can make a wall as high and as thick as you wish, High Warden.
The earnest gnome said as he glanced up at me. And just like that, I had 21 titles to my name.